they taught me very young in California schools that it's not about who picks up the gold on the ground. It's who's able to start some kind of business with that gold. And so the person who starts Palo Alto, Leland Stanford, is not a gold miner per se, right? His brothers are grocers and they'd start a hardware store, SAS Grocery. They're a business who sell to these the gold miners. He's always making money, not in the way that you'd think you would be making money, but in the other way. So even when the railroad hits big, it's not off the railroad that he's making money. It's off the land development company that's speculating on land prices near the railroad.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket
Hello.
Website.
Hello, welcome to Haymarket Live. I'm Malcolm Harris. I'm the author of, as you can see, Palo Alto, A History of California, Capitalism, and the World.
Yes, thank you, Jeanette. Also, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on. I'm about to read it,
but it's quite substantial. Oh, sorry. Right. I'm Tumneet Gabru, and I'm the founder and executive director of DARE, the Distributed AI Research Institute. And we're an interdisciplinary research institute based out of, currently we have people in three continents, U.S., North America, U.S. and Canada. We don't have anyone in Mexico yet, EU and Africa. So should we get into it? Should we get into this?
We are already into it. We are live at Haymarket Live. I was really excited to get to talk to you, Tumneet, because I feel like our works overlap a lot, where you're dealing very contemporarily with the latest instantiation of Silicon Valley values and what I call the Palo Alto system that goes back over 150 years. And you're dealing with like the exact same stuff I'm talking about throughout this 700-page book. In the present, and it's like the ghosts of this past are harassing you day by day by day. And so our work's really like right up against each other. The implications of the history are live, much like ourselves on Haymarket Live.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like what I'm trying to do right now is learn the stuff I should have been learning, you know, when I was in school in Palo Alto. I guess Stanford's its own city,
it's not. It's Palo Alto. They call it Stanford, California, but it's a lie.
Yeah. So basically this, I feel like I'm trying to learn the actual history and actual what was going on rather than the propaganda that I kind of learned doing engineering, electrical engineering at Stanford. And so, you know, I have your book, I have Wendy's Abolish Silicon Valley, you know, I'm trying to just educate myself. And so I'm actually wondering if, you know, in your book, you start all the way at 1850. Your sections are basically 50-year periods, kind of, more or less, right? So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about, you know, what was going on? Why did you start in, 1850? And what's like the main thread? I know eugenics is a big one.
Yeah, well, in eugenics, it's something we get to talk about because I feel like it connects our work and it's totally a through line and really is so much of the Palo Alto Project. And so people who don't expect to see eugenics as this sort of California project, who might think of it as something older, you might be surprised when you open this book. So I start in the mid-19th century, both because that's the beginning of Anglo-American Alta California history, right? That's the colonization of this territory by Californians who we now understand to be Californians for the first time. And at the same time, it's the triggers this period of global capitalism. And so the foundation of this territory that we now, that's become so important to this period of history, also inaugurates that period. And so it's a really useful bookmark for me. And one of the backgrounds to doing this history is a discussion, sort of national discussion about American history that sort of refounds the story of American history in the 1870s and looks at the 1870s, at the post-Civil War United States, and says, this is really where the country of today starts. And California doesn't really get included in that story as something that also starts in that period. But Palo Alto itself begins in the 1870s. That's when Leland Stanford, you know, takes his wife and his one son and flees the class conflict of San Francisco, flees the Working Men's Party who are outside his window yelling at him, and moves to the suburbs. But the suburbs don't exist yet in the 1870s. You have to found one. And so he founds one. He calls it Palo Alto. And
what,
that's
I
the
beginning. I didn't know that.
Why does he what?
I didn't know that. It was Leland Stanford who...
It was Leland Stanford who founds Palo Alto and founds it like literally to escape the class conflicts that he triggers. And so from the beginning, it's the Working Men's Party yelling at him to fire his Chinese workers. That causes the eruption of Palo Alto. And so Palo Alto is a safety valve for the class conflict of the 1870s. And this is, you know, Paris Commune times. This is like things are really kicking off all in cities all over the world between the working class and the ruling class. And the ruling class figures out this strategy of, look, we got to move to the suburbs. We got to get out of here and move somewhere where we're in charge of everything that goes on for as far as the eye can see. And that, as far as the eye can see, right, that 8,000 acres is what then later becomes Leland Stanford Junior University.
Yeah, that's not what we learned in orientation. That is not really what.
But they tell you about the horses, right?
Oh, yeah. They tell us about, I think what I remember is that the son died really young, and in his honor, that was, you know, when Stanford was built, and it's a wonderful story, and, you know, they're all angels, and that's kind of, that's kind of what we learn about. And then you also, said earlier that the gold rush was another, big thing that you talked about. And I'm really interested in that because I was recently talking about how there's an AI gold rush right now, a similar kind of dynamic right now. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the gold rush becomes the real model for California capitalism, at least spiritually, into the future. And like you said, into like right now, right? The gold rush has been used to describe every single commercial innovation, every single cycle in Silicon Valley history, and even pre-Silicon Valley history, if you go back to, like, you know, the agricultural land gold rush or whatever. And it's because there's just no better speculative metaphor for, like, there's money on the ground, everyone come to the money game, you know? It's like, yeah, free money for everyone, come here as fast as you can. It doesn't beat that, right? And so when Netscape is taking off as in the 90s, it looks like a gold rush. It's the same thing. It's money's on the ground for whoever's around here. And yet it was, and they taught me very young in California schools that it's not about who picks up the gold on the ground. It's who's able to start some kind of business, you know, with that gold, who's able to speculate on something from that position. And so the person who starts Palo Alto, Leland Stanford, is not a gold miner per se. He's a growth. Right? His brothers are grocers, and they start a hardware store, SAS Grocery, as are the other associates, the capitalists who join Leland Stanford to build the railroad eventually. They're these petty, you know, grocers, basically. They're a business who sell to these, the gold miners.
Yeah.
And that's he's always making money, not in the way that you'd think you would be making money, but in the other way. So even when the railroad hits big, it's not off the railroad that he's making money. It's off the land development company that's speculating on land prices near the railroad. It's off the rail company that's contracting rails to the railroad, which they also own because it's smart to own your subcontractor. And so these financial strategies from the beginning that build the California capitalist class into something that matters are ones that you see totally into the present. And Leland Stanford is really one model for the California capitalist that I think is great, partly because everyone's making fun of him the whole time, even that, like, even his co-capitalists are like, this guy's a goofball. You know, he doesn't know how to make any money. Money just gets made for him. Like, we're doing all the work. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't know what he's doing. He just wants to go play with his horses, because that was sort of the only thing he was interested in was horses.
That's just so interesting how it's like the same story and a different characters, you know, same movie, like we're on season 10 or something, you know, same show. Because it, what you were saying about like, that's exactly what I was trying to say when I wanted to say that there's like an AI gold rush right now, in the sense that, you know, not everybody's necessarily making money in the way that you expect them to, but like everybody's mm-hmm. cashing in. And I'm like, sometimes I'm like, man, like if I were only able to cash in, you know, like I know the ways in which, you know, there's like consumerism, like give me money to stop the existential risk. Uh-huh. And then there's like the, oh, utopia, it's going to solve everything. And then there's, I don't know, like there's all of these adjacent like things that are happening where they're cashing in from this gold rush, or like there's the press, right? Like the media frenzy, and
selling shovels is what they called it, you know, back, because you don't make money from the gold mining, because very quickly that becomes pretty difficult. But if you've got the shovel selling monopoly and you're selling shovels at really high prices to everyone, and I look at like the metaverse, right? Like very recent, you know, opened and closed since I wrote this book. But it's like, who made money off the metaverse? It's like, well, the consultants, some guy who wrote a metaverse bestseller made money off the metaverse, right? And I look at like AI, so-called, or whatever, the large language model software boom. And it's the same thing where it's guys being like, let me sell you on 7 ways to make money using ChatGPT. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's the same thing. It's like, well, the only people who are making money here are the ones who are selling us like shovels that we can go mine with. No one seems to be finding any gold or whatever, except for the speculative bets on some of these big companies.
What I find interesting is the whole eugenics, that eugenics, so few people, like even when I started talking about eugenics, I got very much attacked, because people basically just think eugenics equals Nazis. But for, you know, you write about eugenics in your book, and you also, you know, and many of us know that, it, you know, California was a hub of this ideology. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, I want to address the Nazi connection early, because sort of California and California eugenicists' rivalry with Germany and German eugenicists is very interesting, because they're building at the same period, right? The 1870s, the same time that California is rising to its like early power, Germany is distinguishing itself as a state for the first time. So the same forces that are pulling California together and into world capitalism are pulling the German provinces into a state as well. And so you see the rise of science and technology in both places, and they're drawing from each other. So Leland Stanford, before there's Stanford University, the first thing in Palo Alto is the Palo Alto Stock Farm. And it's the largest trotting horse breeding and training facility in the world. And he says, I'm going to reinvent the production of horses. He says there are 13 million horses are engines of the country at this point. They drag, canals are horse operated, streetcars are horse operated, agriculture street is horse operated, the military machinery is horse operated. They got to drag, you know, all your provisions and cannons and stuff. There are 13 million horses in the country. California farms in particular, because they're technologically advanced, are particularly horse intensive at the end of the 19th century, that they use 3 times as many horses as the average American farm. And Leland Stanford says, I'm going to reinvent horses, and I'm going to disrupt horses. Even though this is an ancient technology, horse carriages, I'm Leland Stanford. I'm a, you know, technologist. I'm a capitalist. I have new powers. I can scale in ways that no one else has been able to scale. And if I'm going to raise the value of every American horse by $100, which is worth $1.3 billion, if you multiply it all out, $1.3 billion. And it's like perfect disruptor math. And so he does, and he builds the largest horse training facility in the world. And he's also going to change his method. And he's going to create this new method that he calls the Palo Alto system, with his head trainer, this guy named Charles Marvin.
What's the Palo Alto system?
So this is what they invent to reinvent the trotting horse, which are the horses that are pulling things. Mm. And people might be familiar with these efforts. It's through the works of Edward Muybridge, who invents moving pictures just as like an auxiliary side effort, just part of this attempts, right? It also invents motion pictures. So it's like a real scientific effort here, a real commercial effort. But so they decide that they're going to shorten the length of horse production. That horse raising wisdom till this point has held that you don't race horses as fast as you possibly can till they're a couple years old, because the risk is too great that you're going to spoil the horse, that you're going to break a leg or snap a ligament or something, and it's not worth it. And Leland Stanford says, well, I can scale it the way no one else can. I can afford to waste a bunch of horses. And in that process, we're going to find out who the fastest ones are when they're 1 year old, when they're infants. We're going to raise the fastest, youngest horses, and then we're going to invest in those ones, and then we'll be able to have their genetic material extracted faster, and so we'll be able to profit faster. And to this end, he looks to Germany, where Germany has created this new institution for early childhood education, because they say that childhood education is very important to the creation of this new state. And so we need to create institutions for state education of young children. And this institution is called the kindergarten. And there is no kindergarten in America west of the Rockies at this point. They didn't have them for kids. But yeah. Leland Stanford says, I'm going to build a kindergarten for horses. So he builds a shrunk down track where they can race yearlings as fast as they can. And this is a successful effort. They end up raising the youngest, fastest horses in the world with the Palo Alto system. Now, this ultimately is not as useful as like he projected it would be, because steam power and then mm-hmm. gas power overtake the horse. But the Palo Alto system, and people like in Palo Alto don't know what the Palo Alto system is, right? Like, you never heard, you're as tech as they get, right? You never heard that term. Even though it's such a great metaphor and such a great, like, example.
Yeah. Like, all of the things you said are like, yeah, this is Silicon Valley. I'm going to disrupt and scale. I can afford to lose a few, you know?
Right, and like youth, you know, we got to invest in youth. And the assumption that the traits displayed by the infant are the same traits that'll be displayed by the adult. And so that like, and they say, you know, in their writings about this system, that you don't have to worry about, you know, whether this horse can handle the speed or not, because if their leg breaks, well, that's just, they could never have handled it anyway. And so you're just getting early information, and early information is always valuable. And so it's better to break a horse younger than to wait to find out that till they're 5 years old and they're not the fastest, then who cares? You know, then you wasted 4 years of resources that could have been put on a faster horse that you could have found out when they were infants. And then I look at someone like Sam Altman, or even someone like Elizabeth Holmes, who like understand that, and they understand what people are looking for and what the market's looking for. And they understand the Palo Alto system at a real like bone level. And they say like, I'm worth more if I drop out as a freshman, like I'm worth more if I drop out now, cause I'm younger. And they understand that like people see them that way, and that they're still enacting these, like this Palo Alto system. And that was just like the first eugenic step of Palo Alto, right? Like that's just one.
You know, the way I started looking into this, and it's not even my area really, you know, I'm supposed to be a technologist and I'm supposed to be an engineer and a scientist and building things, but there's so many messed up things that are going on. I wanted to understand what was driving the current AGI mania, right? Artificial general intelligence mania. Like, where did this come from? What, you know, why is, because when I was working and when I was studying in the space, like 10 years ago, even, it wasn't this mainstream thing. Like, so, you know, OpenAI and friends and DeepMind and all of them, their mission literally says they want to build AGI, right? But that wasn't like the mainstream thing in quote unquote AI. Like, that wasn't people's goals weren't like, you know, to build AGI. And then, you know, the whole, you know, warning. And so it's like weird because at the same time, they're like, oh my God, we have to build AGI. That's the goal. It's going to bring utopia for everybody. It's going to like solve all your problems. I mean, the way they talk about it when you see them, it's like, oh my God, it's going to be a benevolent God. You don't even know how amazing it's going to be. And, you know, human flourishing, whatever. And then on the flip side, they're like, oh my God, it's so existentially dangerous. You know,
and it's going to murder us all. It's going to torture us all.
It's like, okay, which one is it? And so, and like every day now, there's this, we're like bombarded. I was telling my team, it feels like a DDoS attack by one of these institutes. Like just today, there is yet another. You know, now it's not even a letter. It's like a sentence that people are signing on about the existential risks of AI. And now it's become super mainstream. So, you know, 10 years ago or something, when Elon Musk would say that we're summoning the devil with AI or whatever, people were making fun of him, you know, and now all those people are just joining in. I mean, it's like a feeling.
We can still
like
make fun of them. I'm still making fun of them.
I mean, me too. But it really feels like the gold rush. Even that part of the marketing for me, it really does feel like the gold rush. So like I was trying to figure out like, where is this coming from? And I saw Emil Pitouris, who was a former long-termist, kind of writing about long-termism and stuff. And you know, and I was around these people for a while, like when I was in Silicon Valley or when I was, you know, a grad student and stuff. I remember I met these effective altruists and they had a conference on effective altruism. And I'm like, what's effective altruism? Where, well, it's about doing the most good, you know, more efficiently and, you know, figuring out how you can do it with limited resources and maximizing utility and stuff. I'm like, okay. And then I'm like, who is your speaker? Their main speaker was Peter Thiel. And he was talking about how if you want to do the most good ever, you got to work on AI. And I'm like, why? How did you come to that conclusion? And they're like, well, you know, even if there's a 0.00 whatever percent chance of AI destroying humanity, and it's going to happen 1,000,000 years from now. So it's most important for all of us to make sure that we stop doing that. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm just going to get away from you guys. Right. But now I can't do that because it's like
because they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. And I'm like, I feel like I'm living in a different planet or something like that, because it's just so strange. And so I was trying to figure out, like, why did this happen? How did this happen? So I was like reading up on this stuff, like all this, you know, these people prophesizing, for instance, about the singularity. I don't know if you've heard about the singularity, you know, how, oh my God, the singularity is coming and it's going to be in 5 years. It's going to be in 10 years. Or like they change their calculations every so often. And once the singularity happens, man and machine merge and it's all going to be amazing. And we're not even we can't even know how great it's going to be. It's like the same language that Sam Altman makes, has. And so I kind of had a hunch in that I was seeing a similar language, you know, with people I was, you know, around like 10 years ago, I was trying to get away from them. Then I was seeing Emil's writings. It was like similar language, but I didn't even know, like, I remember Bostrom's book and all that, but I didn't remember there was a thing called long-termism. I knew about the effect of altruists, but I didn't know that term. And then we start look into it. It's like, you know, the people who wrote the first book about AGI are calling it transhuman AGI. You know, they want to create basically like a matrix is the only way I can describe it, where people upload their minds and colonize the cosmos, and they call it paradise engineering, you know, and like they think that this is how we're gonna fulfill our human destiny. And like, we look into it and we see that the first, you know, the one of the first transhumanists was the president of the British Eugenics Society. And actually talking about in these terms, like there's some collective destiny that humanity is supposed to reach. And now it's not even just like, you know, reaching that destiny that humanity is supposed to reach, but transcending all of the issues, the, you know, of humanity. Like, mm-hmm. you're not frail anymore and all of that. And I'm just like, how can people not see the eugenics connections, right? And so the first attacks we got was because, you know, people think, okay, eugenics equals Nazis, right? They're not associating it with scientists, Leland Stanford, right? Or Silicon Valley. And so like trying to make these connections, because, you know, what I was trying to say to even to engineers was like, if you know this connection and you know how it came about, you probably, this is probably not your goal. Like many, many engineers, you know, there's the top echelons, and then there's a, you know, there's a whole bunch of, you know, foot soldiers, and there's like a whole pyramid, right? And so I'm like, I've gone to school, I've worked with some of you, like, I bet you, you know, this is not what you want to advocate for, right? But it's still like a really difficult case to make, because there, you know, the histories you're talking about with respect to California, the sterilization, you know, and all of that, and Shockley, you know, and how he wrote so many eugenics texts, and the first Stanford president, Jordan, being a eugenicist. I didn't even know that until I read about the Stanford Eugenics Project. And, you know, and it's like not seen as a progressive scientific movement, which is what it mm-hmm. was, right? And so we still just get so many attacks for connecting any of these things to eugenics.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Going for Broke, Living on the Edge in the World's Richest Country, edited by Alyssa Quart and David Wallace. From the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, Going for Broke gives voice to a range of gifted writers for whom economic precarity is more than just another assignment. Featuring introductions by luminaries including Michelle T., Kianga Yamada Taylor, and Astra Taylor, Going for Broke shows us the costs of income inequality to our bodies and our minds, and demonstrates real ways to change our conditions. As Gabriel Winant puts it, this moving anthology breaks down the barriers between experience and interpretation. Its contributors explore the underside of American society from many angles, but they do more than document hardship. They show how ordinary people who've been exploited and left behind forge understanding and solidarity out of the experience. Find Going for Broke at haymarketbooks.org.
Well, that's why I think the setting up the historical relationship between the Americans and the Californians in particular and the Germans is really worthwhile, because it continues into the David Starr Jordan era, because when they start the university, their first president is this guy, David Starr Jordan, who comes out of Indiana University. You know, they're basically starting like Elon Musk University in the middle of nowhere in California. And they're like, hey, president of Harvard, like, do you want to come be president of Stanford? Will triple your salary. And they're like, no, fuck off. Like, so none of the Ivy League presidents like want to go be president of Stanford University in the middle of nowhere in its first year or whatever. So they go down the list sort of till they get to this guy, David Starr Jordan at Indiana University. And he's very progressive minded, just as they are, which means he believes in co-ed education, which is a big, you know, the like, the Ivies don't gender integrate fully till like the 80s, you know, like that's still a very like advanced in private higher ed.
Learned about in orientation.
That right. I bet they tell you about that part.
Propaganda.
They're very proud.
Yeah.
They don't tell you why and what they were interested in. It's a like eugenic project by admitting women like intentionally to breed.
Oh, really? People. I didn't know that. Can you elaborate? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So one way I talk about in the book is that they're asking people for their heights consistently, and that they, as a result, you go back through the archives and they have this continual problem with not having enough long beds. And so these articles in the Stanford Daily from like 1930, from 1950, being like, we don't have enough 7-foot beds. You know, the average height of an American male is 5'8", but we don't have enough 7-foot beds. And it's because they associated height with eugenic fitness. And so you go back through the history of Silicon Valley, and it's surprising how many of these people are extraordinarily tall. So David Packard is 6'5", and David Packard is a 6'5", like football playing, basketball playing, like athlete. And that's how he gets picked to lead Hewlett Packard.
But it's not like part of your application. Like you had to write.
Into the 80s.
Into the 1980s,
and I believe is what I said.
Wow, that is
80s or 70s.
Yeah.
But now, and still, if you walk around Stanford campus, and I have people tell me, it's like the number of people, especially now, women who are 6 foot tall or taller, because the amount of athletes, the amount of, you know, that they have these practices.
Wow. But so, how did they? So you were telling the story of when they asked Jordan.
It's hard because there's so many, oh my God, so many tangents.
Like, so many things
DNA of the institution. But so he creates, there's a little bit of true crime history in the book where David Starr Jordan finds a way to take over the school from Jane Lathrop Stanford, who's the Stanford widow. And it's now commonly accepted that she was murdered, poisoned to death. And as a result of that poisoning, whether he was involved or not, David Starr Jordan takes over the university, and he really builds this eugenicist institution that's really, really devoted to producing engineers as part of that eugenic effort. And so one of the things that happens is one of the guys he recruits, professors that he recruits is this guy, Vernon Kellogg. And Vernon Kellogg is part of his association with a member of the first Stanford class, which is an engineer named Herbert Hoover, ends up going to Germany before the United States joins World War I and being a liaison to the German high command. And Vernon Kellogg is this eugenicist. They go by the term bionomics. They're teaching this new subject called bionomics, which is basically like evolutionary psychology back in the day. They were like, not only can we explain biology, but we can explain culture, we can explain society, we can explain labor, we can explain everything.
Section two of your book,
Bionomics.
Part of section two, yeah.
And so they think they can explain everything that way. So Vernon Kellogg is very excited to go talk to these Germans and talk about bionomic theory and evolutionary theory with these Germans.
Yeah.
Part of the German high command before the United States enters World War I. And he writes this long article for The Atlantic about his experiences that gets turned into a book called Headquarters Nights, I believe is the title. And his conclusion is like, yo, these guys are crazy. Like, they think they're going to conquer the world. That like the Jordan idea of eugenics was anti-imperialist because war was dysgenic. Mm-hmm. You know, the bravest young men now were just going to get shot. They're the first out of the trench, just means the first shot. We have to avoid wars because wars are dysgenic. Mm. And we don't want imperialism because I'm too racist to be an imperialist. We don't want the Philippines. We don't want those people in our polity, you know?
Yeah.
But so Kellogg comes back from Germany and says, like, you know, that whole no war thing, the like peaceful development, it's not going to work because the Germans are going to fight and like they're going to try and kill us. And so unless we have some eugenic strategy to fight wars using our best and brightest to win wars without risking their lives, we're screwed. Going. Like, we need to figure this out. So we need, and the Germans, who have been working on education as part of a state power, have already incorporated science and technology development into their war machine.
Yeah.
And so Palo Alto says, we have to come up with an answer to this. We have to be able to fight this war and we have to preserve our genes. So another guy that came over from Indiana University is a guy named Lewis Terman. And he's another eugenicist.
That's demolished now. But I spent some days in that building and it was definitely not friendly to women. Like there was like one bathroom. And it was just like, you know, but the only thing I learned about Terman when I was at Stanford was that he lent money to Hewitt and Packard to start their thing. We didn't
hear this.
Yeah.
Well, and he's most famous for adapting the IQ test, which was this test in France that was used for something different. It was basically for like identifying students who needed extra help at school, whatever. And he was like, the French guy who invented it named Binet said like, don't use this as a test for general IQ. And yeah. Terman says, great, we're going to adapt it for general IQ.
I think it was Terman who did that.
And so that was Terman, and it becomes the Stanford-Binet IQ test, which becomes the, like, and they need this tool to do eugenics for humans, right? To do bionomics for humans, they needed some test that pulled out this generalized IQ variable that they just made up that has no scientific basis. And people said didn't have any scientific basis at the time, but it was really useful for a couple different things. So one of the things, one of the first uses that they did was applying it to World War I draftees. And they would give them the test. It was called Army Alpha and Army Beta at the time. And the idea was you take the A students, and it was split up into five, parts, quintiles, just like we have grades now. The two were connected. And you move the A students away from the front so that they don't get shot. You move them to the ROTC or whatever. You make sure that they're not on the front lines. You make sure the C students are on the front lines. And like the F students, you probably don't want them on the front lines because like they're probably not your best soldiers. Mm. And so that was this use of this IQ test. And it didn't really click into place for me until I found out that Lewis Terman's son, Frederick Terman, who you probably heard about as a Stanford student, becomes very important to the university, turned 18 just after they lowered the draft age to 18. And so this idea of like your genes were at stake, overseas in the trenches was very personal for Lewis Terman and for the Stanford eugenicists, that they had like their children were on campus and he stayed on campus throughout the war and then goes on to be very, very, very important in winning World War II. And so he's a subject of what they called the California genius tests. The Terman genius tests, where they tried to identify every genius, school-age genius in the state of California with the idea that these were kids that you had to support, just like the horses or whatever, and that these would be the future assets of the country, that they would be the science technologists who would be able to win wars for the United States into the future. And one of the people that they tested was Frederick Terman, obviously, Lewis Terman's son, no surprise, genius, which he would have to be because they thought it was an uncomplicatedly genetic variable, right? So if Lewis Terman's a genius, then Frederick Terman's definitely going to be a genius. Lo and behold, he was. But another one of the kids they tested was the only son of two Stanford mining engineers. One of them had been educated there, his mom. And then his dad was a professor of mining engineering at the school. And he was named William Shockley Jr. And he'd grown up in Stanford, and they tested him as a small child. And he actually scored just under the genius level. And that was like a chip he held on his shoulder for his entire life. But so
because
Shockley,
because
he was just on. And so his mom tested like 160s. May Bradford Shockley, who was one of the first female mining engineers in the West, was apparently like off the charts brilliant. So Shockley, who then famously brings the silicon to Silicon Valley, invents the point contact transistor, et cetera. And before that plays a very important role, in fact, just as important a role as Frederick Terman in winning World War II by using his engineering skills, is one of these assets who's identified as part of this eugenic study of California youth at the beginning of the 20th century. And so you don't have to there's no jumps, right, between that history.
I mean,
no jump. It's like a couple generations.
It's a straight line, you know? Yeah, and it's really interesting because it's like such an intentional obfuscation of this history because, you know, I definitely learned about all of these men, right? Mm-hmm. And but there were very specific, facts about them that were just thrown at me, like Shockley, I did device physics, so in electrical engineering. And so definitely we had to learn about like the transistor and how it was built and all of that. Not a single mention. I've never heard the word eugenics the whole time I was at Stanford, you know, undergrad, graduate school, whatever. And then I also, the other really interesting thing is that two obfuscations, right? One is that Stanford was basically a eugenic project. Mm-hmm. But then the second one of the fact that the whole of Silicon Valley was, I mean, actually, this came up in our conversation earlier, so it would be interesting to hear your perspective, is, you know, the whole like pull up your whatever, your bootstraps kind of thing, where like, oh, we're so smart, like we created this whole thing by ourselves and it's our ingenuity that's making us rich, where it's like, no, you got a lot of money from the government in these war efforts. And so you were explaining earlier that you disagree with the, you know, people saying, you know, it's like the California ideology that brought about like the personal computing revolution and all of that. Can you explain a little bit why that is and what actually happened?
Yeah, my anti-Californian ideology.
Yeah.
What's actually very interesting for me as a Marxist, who like the German ideology is a very important book for me, which is Marx's critique of like idealism as a philosophy. And then the Californian ideology, which kind of like takes that title or whatever, is very, very idealistic in the way that Marx critiques, because it's very like, oh, these guys had these ideas, and then those ideas is what produced, you know, the kind of computer world that we had. Mm-hmm. And this history kind of comes in two flavors, where it's the hippies invented the computer and the internet and that's good, and the hippies invented the computer and the internet and that's bad. And the bad version is that's the sort of Californian ideology version you might hear from like Adam Curtis, or like it's almost like conventional wisdom, I think, in some parts of the left, that this is what happened, and that there were sort of that the hippies turned into the individualists who created the computer, the personal computer industry as we know it today. And that they might have had like hippie or new left beliefs back in the day, but that they, without sort of noticing, betrayed those intentions or beliefs. And then there's the sort of the capitalist booster one, which is the kind of official version. Which is like, we all loved togetherness and the Grateful Dead, and we like took some acid, and that showed us that how everything is really connected. Mm-hmm. And so then we created the internet and got super rich because we were right, but also chill. Yeah.
The version that I learn about at Stanford usually.
Yeah, well, and it really is the official history of the Bay, is that like we were so chill that we invented the history, the future, and got super filthy rich. Mm-hmm. And my argument in the book is that neither of those is what's happened, period. And that the conflation that happens, and it's done explicitly in the essay about the Californian ideology that lays out this belief, is the conflation of the new left and the counterculture into one thing. Mm-hmm. But as I talk about in the book, the new left, and then the association with those things as pro-technology, is that there was like new left, counterculture, anti-war, you know, Grateful Dead milieu that loved personal computers and then just like kept playing with toys till they invented Silicon Valley as we know it today. Mm-hmm. That's not true. That's not what happened, like, period. And like the most important thing going on in the world at the time was not the Grateful Dead. It was the Cold War. It was Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so the new left at Stanford in the Bay Area was not pro-technology. In fact, they were trying to blow up literally every computer lab in the country. And they made a significant effort to sabotage and destroy every computer in the country, because they understood that those computers were tools of war, that the Vietnam War was being fought on their campus with these computers. And they bombed them. They bombed the hell out of Stanford campus for years. Which is crazy, right? So like they bombed Slack, like Slack was bombed, the like Center for Advanced Behavioral Studies, where John Rawls was finishing a theory of justice, mm-hmm. was firebombed, and his draft of a theory of justice was almost destroyed. He was woken up in the middle of the night by a call saying like, And apparently his wife said that he answered the call and looked to her and said, "I can't write it again." That then, like, they were lucky that it wasn't destroyed by the sprinkler or whatever. Yeah. But, like, we were this close to never having to read A Theory of Justice, thanks to the militants of Stanford University. And so this idea that, like, that these are the people who they love technology and were confused about what was going to happen in the future and let their idealism pull them down this wrong path is wrong. They thought they were very aware of what was at stake. And when they occupied the applied electronics lab at Stanford, famously, this was like a major moment and was considered a major moment by the left and by the international left as a like moment of solidarity with Vietnam. And so, like, Bobby Seale, the co-founder of the Black Panthers, comes to this occupation and gives it the endorsement of the Black Panthers. Like, Tom Hayden, who's on trial with Bobby Seale after the 68 convention, comes and endorses this occupation. And in fact, after that occupation, something I argue in the book is that the Panthers take inspiration from this action and add popular control over modern technology to the 10-point plan in the second draft after the experience of this occupation. And so, like, these were people who were very, very aware about, like, the social determinants of technology, and they knew exactly what this tech was being used for and how they were going to act in relation to it. And that's a story that gets totally papered over, that, like, no one wants to talk about any of that part. And when you read about them in the official history, if it comes up at all, they're sort of talked about as clowns, as, like, ridiculous. They didn't know what they were doing, didn't know what was going on, because they weren't, like, themselves computer people. And that was, which is not true. Some of them were. It's like Sundiata Kohli, who just got out of jail, was a, like, computer prodigy, was a teenage computer prodigy.
It's the same, like I said earlier, it's like the same movie playing again, you know, and it's like, we don't get to watch part one and two, and part three is like the same with different characters, you know, but, like, 'cause that's the exact same kind of critique of people right now. Well, it's really interesting when you're talking about bombing, because there is a strand of the eugenicists right now, right? And, like, Emil and I have dubbed them the test grill bundle. I believe you talk about Miri and Udovsky and stuff in your book too. And, like, he is talking about bombing data centers, but for a completely different reason, so that, like, we don't create this, you know, apparently, you know, he's so worried about creating some super intelligent god devil, I don't know, thing.
Yeah, it would be a real shame if we created a real super powerful thing that would, like, discipline me. It's like they sound like so, like, so BDSM-y.
China's going to do it if we don't do it. So you also can't regulate us, but you need to think about regulating that God that might be created and is going to be created. We all have to think about that, but also you can't regulate us, because we're creating the good kind and China's doing the bad kind. So, you know, and so what's super interesting for me is that this dude, like, has never had any training in AI or anything like that, whether it's analyzing the social impacts or doing anything. And she was just recently talking about something that made it super obvious. He has no idea what he's talking about, right? And, like, it amazes me how he got here. I just, like, that I have to say, that is a skill. Like, how did you scam your way to the top and create an institute, MIRI, Machine Intelligence Research Institute, right? And get op-eds on Time and stuff. I just wrote a whole word back to TED, the TED people who asked me if I would be interested in participating in something or another. I'm like, let me tell you, you know, I had a whole thing to them, because I'm like, how, you know, and he also has very openly worried about dysgenic pressures and musing about, oh, the IQ test seemed to be dropping in, like, some European country. Oh, but I don't think it's because it doesn't seem to be because of immigration. Or someone on Twitter asks him, like, you know, how old At which age do you think a child has a right to life? And he's like, I don't know, but I'm not an expert in this whatever area, but maybe between 1 and 4, you know, like they are such openly eugenicist people with this project. And yet, just like calling it that, it still seems to be like, you know, they get to kind of attack us for it, which is so unbelievable to me.
It really goes back to like this whole Palo Alto mission, which is how do you solve this problem? You know, when they square off against the Germans and they say, how are we going to save ourselves into the future? You know, how are we going to extend this elite project that we recognize, you know, and how do we like maintain our position of inequality in an equalizing world? Right. Do you look at the beginning of the 20th century that the world seems to be on a long-term path towards equalization of all people, right? Like, how do you arrest that process? How do you keep more power in smaller hands? And that's what the Palo Alto engineer is created to do from the beginning, where it's a tool of colonization, where everywhere that they're tearing up the world at the end of the 19th century, which really creates the world that we have today, whether it's the division of Africa or the colonization of South America, really happens with this rush at the end of the 19th century, you know, the colonization of China. And California engineers were the foot soldiers, you know, not the foot soldiers, but the real heralds, right? They were the ones who were directing the mechanics of this. With the skills they learned in California. And it's only literally one generation from William Shockley Sr., who is doing that work, to William Shockley Jr., who before the point contact transistor, before the, you know, Silicon Valley and all that, he's working for the Defense Department and he's writing a paper called On the Economics of Atomic Bombing. And he's saying, measuring everything in terms of man months, and, you know, how much for a bomb, how many man months does it take us to build, and how many man months on the other side does it destroy?
Yeah.
And that, like, strategic bombing is an advancement in the amount of efficiency that you get from killing, but that atomic bombing is such a giant step in lethal efficiency that it's not even that they're so destructive, it's that they're so cheap. That it costs so few man months to, and he's not officially even read in on the atomic, on the, like, Los Alamos project. He just like knows what's going on when he's writing this. And so he writes this paper about like, what are the post-war implications of the existence of atomic bombs and the ability to do so much damage so cheaply. And he says, you know, he basically writes out the mutually assured destruction plan that we're going to have, you know, bombs throughout the world and all these different places pointed in all these different directions. And he sort of muses that, like, well, we're really headed towards the situation where one man could destroy the whole world. And that this is sort of where his brain goes, that it's like, well, if you jump from like 10 to 100 or 1 to 100, then the jump to 100 to 10,000 is no bigger, right? Then like you could just go very quickly to one person destroying the world. Interesting. And when the head of the Air Force adapts this essay into like an official position paper that becomes the U.S. post-war, you know, economic global order that needs semiconductors that William Shockley Jr. is in a perfect position to create, takes out that sentence about one man destroying the world and like cuts that little sort of like psycho bit, because Bill Shockley Jr. is a fucking psycho and everyone who meets him knows he's a psycho. He can't run a company for 5 minutes before everyone leaves. He's obsessed with IQs and competition. He's always making people compete within each other. And so basically his business career flops, even though he's a brilliant technologist. And where does he land? He gets a seat at Stanford University.
Yeah.
He gets an endowed chair that's actually set up by the Ampex Corporation, which is founded by a refugee from the Russian Revolution who is part of the White Russian Army who starts Ampex. But that's a longer story. But so the money comes from the same, you know, anti-colonial conflict or whatever, endows this chair for Shockley. And in this chair, instead of doing, you know, semiconductor engineering or whatever he's supposed to be, physics, whatever he's supposed to be doing in this chair, starts turning Stanford into one of the world centers for contemporary Nazi thought. And there's no
writing about eugenics. I mean, even in the, I feel like, well, the 70s stuff I was seeing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was just so amazing. Like, and I'm telling you, not a single mention of this anywhere at Stanford.
Well, and it's very, very influential because he ends up working with this guy named Jensen, who gets influently, basically Shockley convinces him, you know, he's this Nobel Prize winning physicist sits down this education scholar and says, listen, IQ is real and it's racially linked and compensatory education doesn't work. You're never going to be able to teach black kids to be as smart as white kids. It's just is impossible. And he's a scientist and I'm a Nobel Prize winning scientist and I'm telling you this. And he convinces them. And Jensen ends up being one of the most important, you know, most influential racists in the 20th century. And that's because he has that chair, just very directly.
Just recently, there was this paper manuscript from Microsoft Research. They had, I haven't read the whole paper. I'm not going to do it. They claimed that GPT-4, whatever, maybe it's GPT-3. I don't even know. Just the OpenAI's chatbot has sparks, quote unquote, sparks of AGI, artificial general intelligence. I'm not even going to deal with this. So Emily M. Bender starts going through the paper, and her mantra is always look at the footnotes. You know, she's like, always look at the citations. So the first or second citation they have in the paper in the intro is, and this is a thing they put on archive, it's not peer reviewed, is a link to an editorial of a bunch of people defending Charles Murray in 19 after his book, you know, and because there was an outcry, and they write this editorial defending him. And this is like a few weeks ago, you know what I'm saying? And so here is this paper talking about, you know, artificial general intelligence or whatever, and their second citation is to this thing. And I think they changed it now after she brought it up, but it just tells you that I'm not, you know, when I talk about eugenics and AI, I'm not even talking about them, right? The ones who are like just citing whatever, and you'll say, you can say maybe they didn't, you know, read it and didn't know. I'm talking about the Yudovskis. I'm talking about the Bostroms, talking about dysgenic, you know, pressures as an existential risk of, like, you know, stupid people reproducing as an existential risk and stuff. And then they'll be like, oh, no, but I was just in the same, you know, I just worked with him. I just cited him. It's not like I'm not a eugenicist. I don't have a sign that says I'm a, you know, eugenicist. I'm like, well, you're saying all the things. You're doing all the things. You're advocating for all the things. And it's like, even if you weren't explicitly advocating for it, which you are, the undercurrent is that, you know, as your book shows, even as this conversation shows. Even if we were not talking about the explicitly eugenicist people, which there are, even if you don't address that, the undercurrent is that, basically. That is what Stanford was built on. That's what Palo Alto was built on. That's what Silicon Valley was built on.
Well, and even just like the figure of the Stanford engineer, no offense, was created with the idea that we need to create people who can keep the rest of the world at bay. Right? People who can exercise an amount of power that reflects their intelligence and their skills vis-a-vis the rest of the world and are able to dominate them with it. And that this is a crucial part of the American project. And so when people say that, like, oh, Silicon Valley's just a bunch of like hype or just a bunch of fluff or it's all Theranos or like there's nothing really there. Mm-hmm. There's an element of that, like it's true. And I do think that like OpenAI is fake. And I think that like Sam Altman has that grin on his face 24/7 because like if he stops, like you're going to see the fear in his eyes that like he has promised the world that he can spin straw into gold. And like he absolutely knows that he cannot knows how to do that.
Honestly, I think the AI cycle goes and, you know, there's winters and stuff. And so like they do this and then people forget and then they do it again. And then
And cybernetics. Is like, you know, this has been going on for almost a century now, the idea that like, oh, we're just around the corner, they're going to automate everything or whatever. So there is like, that is true. And I don't want to say that that's not the case. And like, Elon Musk is a clown show, like whatever. But there is a real project here. And that's where I talk about Thiel in the book. And that's where I talk about Shockley. And that like the first generation of silicon chips all went into the Minuteman I nuclear missiles. And like that was a real project, right? That was a gun aimed at the world's head saying, if anything happens to America, everyone dies. And like that's a real thing. That's a success of the Palo Alto system. And that project continues into, you know, so I write about the Iran-Contra scandal and the shadow government that's being run out of the White House in the 80s, being run on laptops that were created by a spinoff from the Palo Alto Research Center from Xerox PARC. Mm-hmm. And that we don't talk about that as part of the legacy of Xerox PARC is like the Reagan administration and Iran-Contra and the, like turning the world into a series of massacre sites, right? And then even in the Iran-Contra story, we don't talk about Angola and we don't talk about Afghanistan and we don't talk about a lot of like the actual Cold War history that's part of this and the role of company called, you know, the front company for Iran-Contra, the whole thing was a company called Stanford Technology Corp. And it was led by a guy who was a sales agent for Hewlett-Packard, you know? And it's like this is Palo Alto history. This is this is what this place is for. And people don't like telling that version of what this place is for. But it has a real project. There is something substantial here. And so when I look at now, you know, when I look at Thiel's work doing not just Palantir, but Anduril and doing like, you know, border robots, you know, that they're investing in a real project and that real project is American domination.
I'm looking at the questions.
I probably already answered them.
Bet, this is related to what you were saying. Somebody says, I'm curious if the David Sachs, Peter Thiel crowd has responded to or addressed your book and any of what you lay out in any of it at all.
It's a long book. These people are notably not big fans of reading books in particular. So I don't expect
some of them have openly said that, right?
Yeah. Right. So like, I don't really think they're going to, I'm a communist, right? Like, it starts with, in the first page is like Karl Marx says, so like, I don't know if that's how they're going to spend their time just to, I've had a couple of like Twitter VCs sort of bluff about reading it and you like ask them a couple questions and it turns out like maybe their definition of read is a little different than like my definition of what it means to read a book. So no, I haven't heard anything directly from them, but if they were to engage with it, I think honestly, they might be surprised. So like some of the conservative reviews of the book have actually been pretty strong, in that they're like, yeah, he's a commie, but like there's some interesting history in here or whatever. And I think, especially some of the Palo Alto capitalists who like during this whole Silicon Valley Bank collapse were trying to explain what their politics were. And people were like, weren't you a libertarian? Why do you want the government rescue your bank?
I think Sam Altman was like, if the name of the bank was something different, like farming or whatever, it would be different. I'm like, well, aren't you the one who doesn't want government to regulate you? Also, farming is about food. They give us food. Like, I want them to, I care about like that, you know, industry. Like, you're not making me food, right? Like, it's just so, and they were whining, like they couldn't even wait 2 days, right? And
I know, they really gave away the game. But they could learn a lot about their own history in this book, because like, they don't know where their politics are. They know like individually in individual situations, like where their interests are, but they don't know what that political ideology is. And they don't know about Herbert Hoover and they don't know about like associationism and like what they're actually doing. So they should read this book and find out, like there are some answers in them if they have to do it like non-defensively.
Another question is, it says, I'll take the questions for me too, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts here. It says that your book closes with a proposal to give the land Stanford sits back to its indigenous people. But despite being reasonable in the sense of being a logically sound argument, you also seem to think it'll never happen if the Board of Regents is left to its own devices. I agree with you. They just started doing land acknowledgements like now. Like it wasn't happening when I was a student there at all. Even forget giving back land. And so what does it take to make something like that happen?
Well, it's interesting. If you actually go, I encourage whatever audience they get, I always encourage people to Google it. If you Google the Stanford Land Acknowledgement, on that page, they have a sentence disclaimer that says, we recognize that land acknowledgements are insufficient and we need to look to land back as a solution to these historical crimes or whatever. I know. And it's but it's very funny because that line is saying rhetoric is not enough. We must have stronger rhetoric. And it's
have little endowment of billions of dollars and we don't know what to do with that.
Tens of billions of dollars, thousands of acres, including a number of sacred and burial sites. And there's sometimes the reaction from people is what do you mean the indigenous people? Or what are you talking about? You can't just do I have to leave or what indigenous person, et cetera, et cetera. The Mwekma Ohlone tribe, which the university acknowledges as the ancestral title holders of this land, is a 614 person organization. Everyone's been genetically tested compared
to
remains.
Land tax too, right? That people can just pay.
The Shuma is actually a different Ohlone organization in the East Bay. And so it's hard because it's very the history is somewhat disputed and different organizations have different versions of their ancestral territory or whatever. But Stanford acknowledges and the evidence that I've seen and the work that I've done confirms the contemporary organization of the Mwekma Ohlone tribe. And it's not – the Mwekma Ohlone doesn't reject the nativeness of the people who are talking about the Shumi tax, whatever. They're just not part of – they're not an enrolled member of the tribe and they are – my information is that they would be eligible if they chose to, but sometimes people just don't want to be part of the same organizations and that works. That's true of tribes as with anything else. Mm-hmm. But that there is a 614 person tribe that's got stacks of anthropological evidence that has DNA testing. And that Stanford has acknowledged that Stanford has returned remains to this group because it acknowledges them, even though the federal government has refused to acknowledge their tribal existence, Stanford does. And so they have a partner with which they can communicate, with which they can, deal, with which they can return land. And so if they chose not to, it's not for lack of a partner on the other side. And it's not because and again, the history here is really shallow. And I go through it in the book. You can draw – there's only five generations between the current chairman, Charlene. She's great. She's around. People can meet her. she's a real person, a real political leader. Between five generations between her and Leland Stanford. And we know where all those five generations are buried. We know their names, And this is the territory. It's buried under Sandhill Road, buried under the venture capital firms. And so this sort of throwing their hands up and being indigenous, that must be ancient history. There must be the colonization. It's only as long, it's in fact exactly as long as the covenant with the Stanfords, right? It's exactly as long as this 8,000 acres of Leland Stanford University. So if that still exists, if those words still exist, if they're saying you can't sell this land still matters, then why does their theft of the land not matter? Why does Leland Stanford's signature on the documents funding genocide not matter? So at the same time, the question's right. It's why then this obviously should happen. It's very easy to make it happen. We hear colleges make unaccountable left-wing decisions all the time, right? Those crazy administrations, colleges, they're always trying to give land away, I hear. This is what we hear from Ron DeSantis, right? It's these are the hotbeds of left-wing ideology, et cetera. No one should have an easier time than Stanford in, exercising leadership here. But instead, what do we get? We get the John Doerr Climate School brought to you by Exxon or whatever, you know, like this is that's the alternative in yeah. terms of seeing the future. And I talk about in this book, this moment where in the middle of Bill Shockley Jr.'s narrative, when you go, you know, in between being this megalomaniac, Nobel Prize winner, entrepreneur, eugenicist, soldier, et cetera, there's a point where he writes a suicide note and he says, like, I think I'm a bad person, basically. I have too much power and I'm a bad person. And like, I can't trust myself to run the world. Like, I don't trust myself to exist. Puts a gun in a revolver, spins the thing, puts it to his head and pulls the trigger. Survives this game of like Russian roulette, puts the note in a box somewhere and goes on with his life and goes on to like ruin the world. Right. And so it's like, that's also at the core of Palo Alto, is this sort of self-destructive. And you know, when these guys are at home late at night with themselves and they look in the mirror and like,
yeah,
do they really see the guy that they tell everyone that they are? Does Sam Altman look in the mirror at night and see like a magician?
I think he does. I really do think like saving the, I think he does think he's saving the world. Like I, you know, and he surrounds himself with people who are telling him that he's saving the world. And then they all like have this echo chamber. And like, if you say something different, you're one person. So you're that crazy person they just block on Twitter, right? As we're all in that club here.
Yeah. So, I think maybe 95% of the time, but that 5% of the time, or, you know, 1% of the time, I think there's that kernel of doubt where they say, you know, what if none of this is real? What if I'm, and I think that's where I sort of set Thiel apart from some of the other guys. Cause I think Thiel knows that the world exists and knows that history exists and like knows that things outside himself are real. And I think someone like Elon Musk probably thinks that the world is like literally a projection of his consciousness and might not like believe that anything else in the world exists. But like Peter Thiel knows that there is this American project that he is part of and that like he's working towards something.
Very consciously like, yeah, participating in it. And so let me see. I'm going to take a couple of questions here.
We're near time. Even.
Several years on my high profile firing for blowing the whistle on racism. Curious to hear my talk more about the future of ethical AI. Is such a thing even possible? What would it look like? And then there's the other question, should we believe that people like Elon Musk are actually concerned about the dangers of AI taking over society or whatever they're currently going on about, or is it just marketing for something they're trying to sell us? I'm going to start with that question. No, we definitely should not believe them or any of the institutes that are funded by them trying to, quote unquote, warn us about AI existential risks. So like, you know, so the future of life Institute, I can't keep track of them, future of humanity, future of life, whatever, had this conference. I think it was in 2015. I wish I could show you the picture. It was all these white guys on stage, you know, including Elon Musk. And like, I think Ray Kurzweil was there and one of their founders was there and like all of these people, you know, talking about saving humanity from AI. Right. And, you know, Elon Musk funded them, co-founded OpenAI, him and Peter Thiel funded DeepMind, and all of these with this hand, they're funding the organizations that say they're building artificial general intelligence. And then with this hand, they're funding the bozos like Udovsky talking about existential risk in AI. And they're two sides of the same exact coin. Like basically, they think they want to, you know, they're building a god, and if they're building a god, they want to be the ones to do it and control it. And if it's too powerful or whatever, you know, they want you to think about that, not what they are doing, right? So it's a marketing ploy, basically. Yeah. Oh my God, it's this too powerful thing that we've created. So, so in 2015, after this conference that they had, so basically, after Elon Musk and Peter Thiel invested in DeepMind, for instance, and it got bought by Google, they're like, oh my God, we can't control it anymore. And the Future of Life Institute came out with this letter similar to what they're having right now, being like, oh my God, AI can be the devil and this and that. And then they co-founded OpenAI, like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Sam Altman and all these people, because now it's a thing they can control, not Google, right? Now OpenAI is being controlled by Microsoft, so they can't control it. And so they're like, oh my God, another pause letter, you know, danger. Ever. Then Elon Musk the next day says he's doing like some his own version of AI because, you know, OpenAI's version has gone woke. So like just do not pay attention to anything they're saying, which is very difficult to do because the entire media is on them and we have to be distracted by all what we're hearing from them. But it's definitely a ploy. It's like a marketing ploy to distract us from them being the existential risks actually to humanity and what they're doing.
Yeah. Lee Vincel, I think it's his term, uses this term crit hype. And I think it's really great. It's like, it sounds like criticism, but is actually hype.
It's actually hype. Yeah.
And I think that like, you know, that really nails the whole thing. Cause it's like, that's just what it is. It's crit hype.
That's what they're doing.
And they're really, and it gets very like silly very quickly, I think, where they're like, ooh, the spooky AI, like it would be a shame if it came to punish me and like reveal all my psychological or use a fucking jammer. I mean, like that's, it's like, it's so silly, you know, and it is silly, but at the same time, it's like there are people throughout the world who live in terror of like robots all the time who are flying over their houses and dropping bombs. And that's
that's not
artificial general intelligence. That's just like a slightly more efficient bomb system that like we've been dropping bombs on people for 100 years, and this is the latest way to drop bombs.
That's what you talk about, right? And it really pisses me off because I got fired for talking about issues, and none of these dudes were on our side or whatever. Jeff Hinton was just doing his thing, you know. Meredith was pushed out for talking about military contracts. Even. No, that's not existential risk. So all of a sudden, these guys are talking about quote unquote humanity because maybe they see themselves also potentially being eliminated, but whereas by AI or whatever it is, whereas like all the other stuff we were talking about, it's not them, right? It's all the brown people there, all the black people there, all the poor people there who are being impacted.
Well, and they're selling the drones. They're selling the, you know, those drones have to get chips somewhere. Those drones need software contracts. For example, and I mean, you know, that's what Project Maven was about, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like
people who are talking to us about existential risk right now, that's not what they, you know, those are not the things they're thinking about when they say existential risk. So I think long story short is don't listen to them. But then I'm going to talk about the other question I have, which is talk more about the future of ethical AI. Is such a thing even possible? I think for me, you know, I think that technology, you know, I am an engineer and I am a scientist. So I got into this field because I want to build stuff. I like building things and I like understanding things. And I think that like, if, you know, we can build tools in service of the people we want to support, if that's the foundation with which we start, right? So for example, like one of our projects is on, you know, mapping out the townships in South Africa, because the South African government in its census just doesn't kind of acknowledge, like it's just the townships are lumped in with suburbs. It's as if apartheid did not exist and people had to go to townships. But people in townships know that their lives are not, you know, the same as the people living in suburbs. And if you look at the neighborhoods, you'll know, right? So it's like all over the world, like redlining in the US, you know, any sort of apartheid state has that. And so what we're doing is we are using our expertise in machine learning, computer vision to map out where those are and then like actually do data analysis to provide people with proof so that they can go with tangible things and advocate for change. So I do believe that, you know, you can build tools that it depends on your mindset that helps certain groups of people. However, the entire foundation has to change for that, right? Like if you're going to do what I really don't like is like this whole AI for social good thing, because it to me, it seems like, you know, like you see with this book, the whole thing is based on eugenics and the whole thing is based on world domination and military. And so I liken it to like building a tank. And so like, if you want to, you know, our funding is about that and everything is about that. It's about building a tank. And then once we built the tank, we're trying to figure out, oh, can we do tanks for good? Can we do tanks for agriculture instead? Well, let's not build a tank. Like let's build something else. And we can build something else. There is nothing forcing us as humans to build the tank, right? Except for the power structures and the history and all of that. And so like, it's not like, you know, a law of physics that we have built to build tanks, right? It's like something else that we have to build. So I do think it's possible, but I do think it's really important to understand the ideologies that are driving us, which I think is what this book does, and to have a different set of ideologies instead.
And to question the idea of what intelligence is and the idea of general intelligence, because this is all from a eugenic framework. And if you look at the history critically, there is no such thing as intelligence that can be measured or created or can be, you know, extracted from a body in a way that they think, you know, that intelligence is always embodied. There is no such thing as disembodied intelligence, you know, that we're familiar with. Instead, you have large language modules, or, you know, you have like, we should be specific about what we are talking about. And what we're talking about is software built on the particular training data built to do particular things. Right. And there's a danger in like reifying the algorithm or reifying artificial intelligence or AI. So like, I try to use the phrase AI as little as possible because it's not, that's not, the only word in there I know what you're talking about is artificial, which just means like a computer, right? It's like, what do you mean by intelligence? Like, do you mean knowing the answers to sports quiz questions? Because like, that was the original IQ test, like, and it might know those things, you know, like Watson on Jeopardy or whatever could do good on an original IQ test or even today's IQ test, but like, what does that mean? You have to know the history of these tests or what they're for or whatever. It's like, it's to get yourself out off the front lines so that you don't get killed in the trenches of World War One, I guess, you know? And so when you're like, it does become this philosophical attempt to create something that does not exist, that they have to imagine exists. So I don't believe in like AI period, never mind like ethical AI or whatever. It's like, I can imagine that there would be, you know, if we figure out rudimentary fucking translation glasses that will allow us to speak to other people who don't speak the same language as us, this would be the signature accomplishment of like humanity as it exists, like, period. You know, that's the Tower of Babel, right? That's the transcending our human condition. And it amazes me that this isn't what they're spending the entirety of all of our resources on.
Well,
right?
It's like, even that to me, it's not, I might not want you to understand what I'm saying. And I don't want you to just put on glasses and understand, you know what I'm saying? This is the thing. Like when you, I think machine translation for me is a thing I work on and a thing I like. But, you know, in certain conditions, right, under certain terms, like if it's especially if it's indigenous groups, they might not want you to learn their languages under their terms. And they might want to have, you know, some of their languages online accessible to their own people so that they can interact with the outside world. But they might not want you to understand. So it's like that there is this disrespect of, you know, like what other people want. That's not like the, do you hear my dog? That's not like the dominant paradigm. So hey, stop. Sorry.
Yeah. That reminds me of just a couple of weeks ago at the Stanford powwow where the Muwekma Ohlone, who have been recovering their language and recovering their dances and recovering, you know, their tribal records. And they're attempting to like perform these dances again in public. This was the second time they'd done it, you know, since the 30s or whatever was this year. And they asked everybody in the audience, you know, put your cameras, please don't record this part. You know, you can record the intro and then put your cameras down because we're not trying to have this part recorded.
I was just at a workshop where someone said the right not to be online, right? We have the right to be online, but we also have the right not to be online. Like I come from a country where, you know, the government regularly shuts down the internet and stuff, and I don't want them to be able to do that. But I also want the ability to not be online if I don't want to.
Yeah, and the insertion of cameras into public spaces everywhere and constantly, and the
and being recorded and tracked everywhere, like.
Well, yeah. And that, to maybe to close it out because I think we're hitting time, but to talk about another Sam Altman project, right? Is the to scan everyone's eyeballs in the world.
WorldCoin,
yeah. Which it's pretty amazing, but the idea that like. To collect everyone is this sort of existential human project, almost like Pokemon, right? It's hard to imagine that it's not like Pokemon inspired, right? Like gotta catch them all with this little ball. But the idea that, that you should be able to like transcend the human condition, whatever human conditions exist through technology. The
transhumanists, yeah.
Yeah, it's so core to these people's identity and real understanding of the world at a like philosophical sort of religious level.
Yeah.
That I don't think they're really willing to grapple with, or maybe they're starting to. Now there's like an esoteric turn in Silicon Valley that I'm reading about, right? People like becoming Catholics or something like that.
Yeah, so, I think that it definitely is a religious movement, and it's really interesting because it's by mostly people who just talk about how much they hate religion, right? And like they're replicating, I think, all of the horrible things about large religious, powerful religious institutions, and leaving out any of the good things that people find about religion, whether it's the spiritual, you know, I don't know, human connection or whatever it is, they're doing the complete opposite. I really do believe that their vision is to strip us from humanity altogether. Yeah. Upload your minds, live in the matrix, can talk to a chatbot your entire life. Don't, you know, like no artist, no human art, just like AI, quote unquote AI art or whatever. And it's just such a dystopian future, like one that I really don't, that's not the future I want to live in.
Yeah, they don't believe in God. They want to be God.
Or create it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which is a scary position to be in, but it puts us in sort of a fun insurgent position, right? It's like, all right, well... What happens to gods, you know?
Yeah. I guess we're supposed to wrap up.
We should wrap up.
How do you want to wrap it up?
Thank you all for joining us at Haymarket Live. Follow us on the internet. I don't know. Look us up. We're around.
Well, I'm looking forward to... like really reading your book, and I'm very excited for it. And I think this is a book I really should have had. I wish I had this book when I was an undergrad. And even throughout my graduate school, you know, I think I'm doing a re-education of myself, like stripping myself away from the propaganda that's been, you know, I've been filled with. So I'm super excited to get to it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me, and thanks everyone for tuning in.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.